Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 14, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all opinions are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two guests to our call today. They are Carrie Severino. She's Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Judicial Crisis Network. She'll be joined by Thomas L. Jipping. He's Chief Counsel in the Office of Senator Hatch in the Judiciary Committee. We'll have opening remarks from each of them, then a little bit of back and forth, and as always, audience questions. So let's get right to the program. With that, Ms. Carrie Severino, the floor is yours.
Hi, thanks so much, Dean. So I'm going to start off by talking a little bit about, we're thinking about the next Supreme Court justice, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the general principles that we should be thinking about in this context. First of all, I think, as probably everyone on this call realizes, the next president, and this is said frequently of a lot of presidential races, but honestly, I can't imagine a race that is going to have a more potential impact on the court. And to some extent, you could say, look, if people may have said it last time, but I think it was true last time, and it's maybe even more true this time. Look at what President Obama has accomplished by his opportunity to appoint two new members to the Supreme Court. Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor have been absolutely reliable liberal votes. They vote in lockstep with Justice Ginsburg, and they have solidified the liberal wing of the court for probably decades to come. So that was an incredibly important thing. We're facing another similar moment where the next president will have the opportunity maybe to appoint as many as three Supreme Court justices. There are a lot of justices who are getting into their 80s. Obviously, there's a potential that someone would retire. There's a potential someone would need to step down for health reasons. And the most interesting portion of it is that some of the older judges cross the spectrum. So we have Justice Ginsburg, Justice Scalia, and Justice Kennedy, all of whom are likely to be the next ones to step down. Imagine the scenario if a Ginsburg is replaced by a conservative justice. That would actually shift the court into reliable conservative territory. Similarly, imagine Justice Scalia being replaced by another liberal justice. It would have exactly the opposite effect. And really, whoever replaces Justice Kennedy is going to have a serious impact on the upcoming court. So I think this couldn't be a more important question. I think the first point I want to make is that when we're looking for how the Supreme Court's going to look following this upcoming election, is there's a lot more to it than just, is this person going to appoint Republicans or Democrats? And in a lot of ways, that it can get confused because of the way that the press points it out, but I'm sure Federalist Society members realize there's a whole lot more to it than that. We have such stellar examples of Republican judicial nominees as William Brennan, Earl Warren, Justice John Paul Stevens, David Souter. All of these were Republican nominations, and with some of them with more or less understanding of what their judicial philosophy would be. But take someone like Earl Warren, for example. He was a lifelong Republican. He ran for office as a Republican, but his judicial philosophy was very, very liberal. So this doesn't necessarily line up with a political description. So I think here are, in my opinion, sort of three key things that the next president should be looking at when they're looking for their nominees. First of all, they should be looking for someone who not just has an R versus a D next to their name, but really looking at their judicial philosophy. Now, this means someone, of course, who's going to be faithful to the Constitution, who's going to view it from a textualist and hopefully originalist perspective, and when interpreting statutes, is going to feel that they are actually constrained by what the statute says, not someone who's going to be searching around in additional, whether it's legislative history, whether it's, you know, speculating based on the intent of Congress in other ways, whether it's looking to other country statutes, whether it's looking to public opinion, all of these other sources of law, which of course may become popular in certain liberal legal theories, really just open the door for judges to import their own politics and their own policy preferences into what they're doing. So we want someone who's going to have a philosophy that actually constrains them. So they're not looking first to what do I think based on my gut feeling is right, but what is the actual, you know, here's a neutral principle. And there's more than one neutral judicial philosophy out there, but I think You know, we need justices and judges, appellate judges as well, who are going to have one that's not, that goes much farther and is more robust than simply finding a legal explanation for whatever they feel like doing at the time. Because we know anyone in the category is going to be considered for these level of jobs is smart enough to find a legal cover for whatever they want to do. We need someone who has some principle behind that. And second, when looking at this principle, I think it's important to find someone with actual evidence of that, of those principles. So it's not just a matter of someone who knows how to answer the questions the right way. I think that's one downfall of the success of the conservative legal movement is now everyone knows what the code word is. You even hear when liberal judges are being asked questions in their confirmation hearings, they know they're not supposed to say, "I'm making up the law." I mean, Justice Sotomayor said, I don't make law. I want to stick to the meaning of these things." But you have to look to their actual work to find out what does that mean. And in most cases, the best evidence we're going to have is someone who actually has time on the bench. That you can see what they were really doing. Someone has a lot of years as a lawyer. Sure, that's probably useful, but as we all know, you're representing your client's interests, and so and not necessarily your own, you know, legal argumentation. I think it's very important to see what someone does when they're not simply trying to get a court to buy an argument, but when they're really someone's really asking them what is the correct argument. So I would argue that, except for I can't try to think of a really exceptional case. I suppose law professors as well. You have a long record, perhaps, of their unlimited ideas of what their actual position is. But you want someone who has a lot of evidence out there. And then finally, I think it's important to look for someone with courage, someone who stood up for those principles that they're now telling you they espouse, but also has done it when it looked like it was not in their personal interest to do so, because as we all know, there are a lot of cases in the court where the justices come under significant fire from the media, certainly from their own colleagues in the court. You need someone who has evidence that they are willing to stand up and be counted for a principled position, even when they might not be getting applause or op-eds and editorials written in their favor as a result. And I think the final comment would be that those are what the qualifications we need in a justice. I think the final qualification is one that goes to the president, and that's we need a president, hopefully, who will be willing to put the political capital out there to nominate someone who really does have a solid record on all these things. Many of the disappointments that to Supreme Court justices we've had have been because people were more concerned about trying to find someone who would be easy to get through the nomination process, not be a major political battle, and rather than someone who they know absolutely without question has a conservative set of judicial principles. So I think it's really important that amongst the panoply of candidates that are out there, that someone really realizes this is something that's worth spending the political capital on, even more than a law they're passing, and more than any other nomination in the executive branch. This is someone who lasts not just 4 years, not just 8 years, but could be 40 years on the bench. We were seeing justices who are sitting longer and longer, so it's a generational impact that this is going to have. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tom to talk a little bit more about how to identify those things from the inside, looking at candidates.
Thanks, Carrie, and thanks for the opportunity to be talking with everybody today. I want to say it up front, the views that I'm expressing are my own and not anyone else's. The principles that Carrie talked about apply to all judicial nominations. They apply in somewhat different ways, but those are the principles about the judiciary as a branch that the founders, I think, established. And so the ongoing process of judicial selection, with the rare event of a Supreme Court nomination, is all about the lower courts. Where we stand today, there are 72 vacancies across the country. That's actually on the low end of where it's been. Three-quarters of the Obama presidency vacancies have been higher than that. The president has appointed 317 judges, compared to 296 for President Bush, 333 for President Clinton, and 336 for President Reagan. The factors I think that the next president is going to face to pursue the goal that Kerry outlined, and I think the goal does have to be to actually appoint as many judges as possible that fit the job description that Kerry outlined. We talk a lot of times about nominations, but the Constitution gives the power to appoint to the president. And so the goal has to be to actually get appointed as many judges that are as close to that job description as possible. A couple of different categories of factors that the president is going to face that may undermine that. One is a public problem, and that is just the general public's misunderstanding of our system of government and the role that judges are supposed to play. It's very difficult to pursue these principles when the public, to whom the president and senators have to answer, either never knew them or completely misunderstand them. Everything has become so politicized that I think most Americans think about judges the same way they do about politicians, that they just exist to deliver the goods. And so it's very easy to be a liberal in this context, because all you have to do is say, I want judges who will give me blank, and either you agree or disagree with what's in the blank. The conservative position is a more indirect one, which is more challenging to describe and connects much less easily to what people already know. So that's a public problem that, frankly, a president's going to have to face, but a president can commit to try to change. There's also some Senate challenges in terms of the confirmation process. There are, for example, different views about what the Senate's role is in this process. There are those who would view it as simply a check on the president's appointment power, and therefore the bar, there's almost a rebuttable presumption for confirmation. There are others who would see the Senate as having a co-equal independent role that is very robust. Now, that shift in the Senate's role, or the understanding of the Senate's role, frankly, is one that Professor Lawrence Tribe championed in the 1980s, and that's what really transformed the confirmation process, defeated Judge Bork and so on. But there are differences of opinion about what that is. The president's party may not control the Senate. And if the president's party does, there can be a lot of cooperation with the confirmation process and trying to get his nominees confirmed. But if the president's party doesn't control the Senate, as is the case today, you'll face a different situation. Here's a contrast. In 2014, Democrats controlled the Senate, and they confirmed 89 judges, which was the most in 20 years. Last year, with Republicans in control, we confirmed 11 judges, which was the least in 60 years. So your party may not control the Senate. Even if your party does control the Senate, there are a lot of factors in terms of how the Senate operates that can be challenging in terms of the president achieving this objective. For example, senators may not understand or even believe in the principles that we're talking about here. Senators may have other priorities. They may understand those principles, and if you'd talk to them, they would say they think they're important, but they've simply got other legislative or parochial interests that are much more important to them. In addition, senators recommend candidates for lower court judgeships and to fill vacancies. And when that process is underway, that is a very local, very personal process. Many personal factors come into play there, and it's entirely possible that senators who would subscribe to these principles generally, the candidates that they recommend are of a different sort and were selected for different reasons. That system of sort of senatorial courtesy has been in effect for almost 100 years and is a defining reality of what happens here in the Senate. And I also think senators sometimes have an all-or-nothing sort of mentality when it comes to the confirmation process. In other words, it's worth pursuing or it's worth having a confirmation fight if we know we have the votes to accomplish either confirming or defeating a nominee. But if we don't, then there's just no value in having a confrontation over a judicial nominee. All of those, and probably more, are elements or factors kind of within the Senate that can be very challenging to proceed through. And I think then what a president needs to do, and Kerry alluded to this, A president has to have a confirmation strategy. He has to have a strategy to get his nominees confirmed, and that confirmation strategy has to be an ongoing priority. Again, every president, just like every senator, has lots of different items on the agenda, lots of different things on the plate. Every president has to decide what kind of priority something like judicial appointments will have. But in order to achieve that goal of appointing as many judges as possible that fit this principled job description, a president has to have a strategy for confirmation and has to make it an ongoing priority. That has to include some attempt to address the public. A president has to explain to the public, this is the kind of judge that I'm going to appoint, and here's why it's important. And that has to be an ongoing, as multifaceted an effort as possible, because the less the public understands about that, the less senators are going to be responsive to it. And I also think that grassroots organizations, and they've played an increasing role in the confirmation process since I think President Reagan was elected, they too can also either help or maybe undermine this goal of appointing these kind of judges. The job description that Kerry outlined there, that has to drive everything. It has to drive the nominees a president selects. It has to drive the confirmation process as much as possible. And grassroots organizations that participate in it and that, for example, comment on nominees or analyze their records, it's most helpful if they keep the eye on that as well. When we get input from groups that want us, that want senators, let's say, to oppose a nominee, but the reasons they're giving are things like, you know, 20 years ago, this senator made a, or this nominee made a comment, you know, in a seminar, or wrote this op-ed in some obscure paper that no one's heard of, or has a personal opinion about this or that. Those are not pieces of information that are real helpful in terms of really keeping the eye on the principles that we're talking about here. So, you know, that can help a president with that confirmation strategy. It can help a president maintain it as a priority, or it can mix the message. It can really divide the conservative side rather than, you know, keep us together. It's more difficult these days to take this conservative position than it is to take a liberal position. It's harder to articulate, it's harder to communicate, it's harder to keep the priority where it needs to be. But unless we do that, I think, you know, presidents appoint on the average about 45 judges a year. The next president in that term can expect to appoint anywhere from 180 to 200 judges. They're going to serve for 18 to 20 plus years on the average. And if the meaning of our laws is in their hands, it makes all the difference who these people are. So the eye has to be on the goal. And with these principles in mind, it's going to be swimming upstream, because our culture and our understanding of these kinds of principles is not nearly what it used to be. And that is a challenge instead of a help sometimes. But I think you can make progress in doing that. And the final thing I'll say, and this echoes a little bit about what Kerry said, when we look at nominees, you got to look at their whole record. You got to look at, when she talked about evidence of that judicial philosophy, you got to look at that whole record. I do think that sometimes a lot of time on the bench isn't the best indicator. David Souter is a good example of that. And there you have the nuances of, you know, serving on a common law Supreme Court and then going to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's some of those difficulties, but you got to look at the whole record. There has to be evidence of what that judicial philosophy is going to be. And I do agree, Kerry made a great point of there has to be ideally some evidence, some indication of a personal courage, a personal character that not only intellectually understands, not only has worked with those principles in the past, but when push is going to come to shove, and it will, that they will Sometimes we refer to judges growing in office. They never grow in the right direction. So they got to stay rooted, and there's got to be some evidence of that. So I think I'll leave it at that and see what other people have to talk about.
Very good. Thank you both. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, let me make a quick commercial announcement about our next scheduled telephone conference call. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the Law of War manual and how it defines the laws of war. It's the first Michael Lewis Memorial Teleforum. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. I promised we'd have a little bit of back and forth before we turn to the audience, so let me revert to Carrie Severino, give her a chance to expand on anything she said, and let me ask a question this way, if I could, and you can answer it or not in your expanded remarks. But what I'm hearing is, when it comes to being effective, it's a combination of not just quality of judges, but also quantity. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts, you know, in the modern era on which presidents have done best, and maybe why, when it comes to quantity, but also when it comes to quality. And you can answer that, give two different answers to that if you want.
Well, I think Tom may have a longer institutional memory of having seen some of these things. But I think that the quantity point is really good, because it also it points out that it's not just the Supreme Court. The appellate courts are key for a couple reasons. One is because they provide people actually correctly deciding law in the meantime, but also that's your bench for who you're going to appoint to the Supreme Court. You can't just take someone off the street and put them on the Supreme Court. You have to have kind of credentialed them in the meantime, and that's actually to look at some of the history. I think actually where the last President Bush did a good job in terms of getting some of these good people on the bench, and at least for the first part of his career of his term. President Obama didn't do as good of a job. I don't know that it's funny as a you know, liking to tout himself as a constitutional law professor. He didn't pay as much attention to the courts as I think he probably should have, but I'm perfectly happy to leave him not focusing on that as much. But I think that was just not, as we talked about, where he wanted to spend his political capital. It's do you want to do it legislatively? Where do you want it to target things? And he did have obviously the two Supreme Court nominations to get. But I think we need a president that's going to be able to focus on filling the appellate seats with really high-quality, principled individuals as well, because those are going to be your next generation Supreme Court justices.
Tom, do you want to take a shot at this or further
sure,
expand your
sure. remarks? I think it all comes down to the degree to which, starting with the president, this job description that we're talking about remains the primary and central criterion for picking judges. To the degree that other factors enter in, whether it's demographics or personal relationships or whatever, we'll get further and further away from the goal. And I think you know, the first President Bush was a good example. Justice Souter, who he appointed, judicial philosophy was not the primary factor, not the primary focus. It was more his chief of staff at the time had a recommendation, and there were some of those personal factors that distracted from the goal, and that's what we got. Justice Thomas, on the other hand, judicial philosophy was the only criterion, and look what we got. So I think it really does boil down to that. Now, like as I described a little bit, there are many, many competing factors, many competing priorities, and not only other issues entirely, not only legislative issues, but different views about the judiciary, the kind of senatorial courtesy stuff that I mentioned and all of that. But the degree to which the actors in this process make that judicial philosophy that Carrie described the central focus and keep it that way, the better off we're all going to be.
Very good. Let's check in now with the audience. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, so let's turn to our first caller.
Thanks for this topic. I'm hoping I can shoehorn my two questions in. I was wondering, I have heard over the years about how strong Alito's opinions are and Clarence Thomas's opinions are. And in recent years, I've also heard that Kagan and Sotomayor, obviously this is going to be from the right, but they don't bring the same intellectual heft or the same strength of opinions that the conservative wing does. So I just wanted to ask the panelists, how important is the intellectual heft and the strength of the opinions that individual justices bring, as opposed to simply how the votes break down? And sort of the second part of that question, how important is Roberts as Chief Justice? How does a Chief Justice direct the future of where a Supreme Court goes? And thanks again.
So going to the discussion about the heft first, I think you can – having an intellectual heft is definitely important because you're ultimately there both for your own vote and then ideally to bring – other justices along with you. Now, some people, I mean, so that this could be seen as one weakness, I suppose, of Justice Thomas's incredibly principled jurisprudence is he's not afraid to go out on his own, and frankly, a lot of times he does have to because he's not someone who's going to be just compromising with other people for the sake of making friends. While he might, you know, write an opinion to keep his fifth vote, he's not going to. Write something totally different. I think that's been an interesting comparison between the liberal wing of the court, the current court, and the conservative wing. If you look even at just at last term, the amount of agreement, I don't have the stats in front of me, but the amount of agreement between the liberal wing of the court is remarkable. I mean, way high up there in the 80-90% all amongst the four liberals in the court. If you just take the four conservatives even, there's a lot more difference of opinion. They might even get to the same place, but by a different legal route, so they're concurring in judgments and things like that. I think that actually is something we should be proud of, because I think it illustrates that there is that intellectual honesty and heft behind our justices. Now, I don't think that necessarily means that someone like, for example, Justice Kagan doesn't have the intellectual heft. I think she certainly does, but I think there's a more pragmatic view toward a unified front on the left wing of the court than amongst the conservatives. They seem to be a little bit more, from my perspective, obviously also a conservative perspective, but from my perspective, they seem to be a little bit more goal-oriented and been pragmatic and like, let's make sure we get the right answer. Justice Scalia kind of called them out on in the same-sex marriage case and for signing on to Kennedy's, shall we say, less than focused legal analysis in that case, saying that he would hide his head in a bag if he had to sign something like that. But I think the liberals are willing to, you know what, if we're winning at the end of the day, it doesn't matter exactly as much how you get there. So that could be seen as a strength by some, but I actually think there's a real strength in the fact that members on the conservative wing of the court have a real principled approach to their judging, and I think we've still seen some occasions where that is won over other justices, and some occasions where they are able to really articulate clearly what their philosophy is, and it's important to have that principle there to illustrate that it's not about just how can I affect my policy goals here, but really it has to do with what does the law actually say. You know, whether I agree with it or not, I'm supposed to interpret the law as a judge, and so you have to respect that. If Tom has any other comments or comment on the Chief Justice, obviously that has a shaping role as well on the court, but he still only gets one vote.
I'm not sure what different people mean by intellectual heft. You know, it'd be nice if there came with some kind of a score, you know, like you're a gymnast or something. You got an 8.7 on that or something. So I'm not sure how you measure that. I also think that, you know, judges generally, the Supreme Court, I mean, they do, in each case, they do two things. I mean, they decide that case, and those are the votes, but then they also explain how, and that's the opinion, that's what affects other things elsewhere and at different times. That's maybe where Your intellectual approach might have more influence. Certainly, Justice Scalia has had a profound impact on just the way that, judges probably generally construe statutes and look at the Constitution, whether they start with the text or they don't or whatever. So, your intellectual capacity and the way that you apply it can maybe have an impact in that broader, more long-term sense. But at the same time, I mean, from a conservative point of view, what are judges there to do? Judges are there primarily to decide individual cases between individual parties. They're not there necessarily to have this, broad, culture-changing, sweeping impact. So, to me, it's kind of a mixed picture as to what the judge's role is. To me, the liberal view of what the judge's role is, is where something like intellectual heft might have more of a role to play. And but on the other hand, I think on the conservative side is where most people see that intellectual heft being. So so I think it depends on what you view the role of the courts to be, and whether you're thinking shorter term in individual cases or longer term in terms of the sweep of the law.
Did we lose Tom Gipping? I think we might have lost Tom Gipping. Looks like his line's been disconnected. We've got a couple more questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question of our guest, push the star button and then the pound button. Let me see if we're getting Tom Gipping back here, if you just bear with me for a moment.
In the meantime, I might follow up on one thing that Tom was saying about the importance of intellectual heft. One real distinction I've seen is in this current court is that Justice Alito and Justice Kagan, I feel, have really contributed in their questions and oral argument in a way that has shaped the argument and shaped the discussion. Now, whether that really moved any votes, I don't know, but I think both of them have very smart hypotheticals and very smart questions that often are really aimed well at the dividing lines in a case. And so that's another way that intellectual heft, whatever that means, can contribute. But again, at the end of the day, how many people's minds are changed, how many of the important people's minds are changed by oral argument, I don't know. It certainly does affect the way those of us on the outside understand a case.
Do we have Tom Gipping back yet? Okay, well, we've got four questions pending. Why don't we carry on with our questions, and we'll see if Tom is able to join us along the way. Just got joined by one other caller. Let me check in with him and see if that's...
Would I be able to follow up with my Chief Justice question?
This is Tom Gipping.
Okay, we've got Tom Gipping back. We've got, if you want to, caller, if you want to re-engage,
sure.
Push the buttons on your phone. Let's try and get to these other calls if we could. Although we might have time to come back to you. Tom, welcome back. We're moving on to our next call, so stand by here.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. Tom, as somebody who lacks intellectual heft, I was offended by your remarks, and that's why I bumped you off the call. I have two questions, both of which have to do with demographics. The first is that I think that all of the justices went to either Yale or Harvard Law School, and with the exception of Kennedy, they're all from the East Coast. So to what extent do you think that there will be pressure to have somebody who's not from the East Coast and not from Yale or Harvard? And then the second question is, how politically difficult is it going to be, whichever party controls the Senate and the White House, to appoint a non-African-American to replace Justice Thomas Scalia?
Well, I think when I referred earlier to, the success of this depends on the degree to which judicial philosophy is the central motivating driving force in the process at all levels, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Unless we're talking about judicial philosophy constantly and consistently, these and other distractions can come into play. Diversity and geography. I never understood what the geography thing was ever about. I mean, David Souter was from the East Coast, and you know, Lord knows Stephen Reinhardt is out there on the left coast. I mean, I don't know what that really means. And to me, that
I have to say that I'm not advocating, you know, either of any of
no, I know
being consideration. I'm just wondering to what extent you
it,
know.
But it does come in.
Senators care about this.
It does come into play, and not so much at the Supreme Court, so I don't think, but it does come into play. Certainly the race and gender diversity issue does, but the way to minimize that is to consistently focus on what we should be using as our criteria. And it would allow a president, you know, to talk about, you know, I want men and women of diverse racial backgrounds who all share this judicial philosophy. You know, you can talk about variety in terms of those other factors so long as the priority is the right judicial philosophy. Your other question is how difficult it would be for the Senate.
A non-African American to replace Justice Thomas.
Again, to me, everything rises and falls with that kind of leadership. If it is a strong president who has said that that judicial appointments are a priority for his administration, and he has a consistent message about judicial philosophy and the kind of judge we need, it minimizes these other considerations and makes them not disappear, but makes them less important. To the extent that we're not talking about that kind of substance, then these kinds of factors are going to be ripe for exploiting by all kinds of political interests.
Carrie Severino, do you have anything on this point, or should we go to the next caller?
No, I absolutely agree, and I think we have a great bench, again, of principled legal minds that hit all of those demographic things. I mean, there's Janice Rogers Brown and Miguel Estrada, people from all across the board, but we shouldn't be picking them because they are male or female or black or Hispanic or whatever race. We should be picking them because they are high quality. I think if we focus on quality, actually, the diversity will take care of itself. I think we're going to see a wide range of these different backgrounds, hopefully, and I think that'll be the way to achieve it. Just to, let's try to not, we're not going to disqualify anyone because of their background, and so it'll take care of itself, I would hope.
Very good. Let's see what the next caller has in mind.
Hi, this is Russell Page. I'm a patent attorney and a Roger Clegg groupie in Washington, D.C. And my knee-jerk reaction might be to accuse Carrie Severino of being a Pollyanna when she's describing the enormity of the stakes, because I do think it's very important. But my question is based more on the history and the enormous opposition that the task will face. And I hearken back to 2000 when staunch pro-life advocate and social conservative Gary Bauer briefly ran for president. He was interviewed on a Sunday morning network talk show and asked if he would have a litmus test for any of his Supreme Court nominees. And he responded immediately, "I will never nominate a bigot." And I believe he did so to counter the intimation that pro-life advocates and social conservatives and even all Republicans are bigots. Fast forward a dozen years, and Sonia Sotomayor is nominated after saying, writing, editing, and publishing her opinion that a wise Latina would reach a correct conclusion more often than a white male, which I believe is bigotry per se. Now, I would ask Thomas Gipping to remind me how Senator Hatch voted on Justice Sonia Sotomayor's nomination, and to comment on whether or not we can actually marshal the forces to approve justices who are nominated according to the criteria that he and Carrie Severino set up.
Senator Hatch voted no on Sotomayor. I think I'll just repeat what I said earlier. The success of this endeavor, the reaching the goal of appointing as many judges as possible who as closely as possible reflect this job description we've been talking about, depends on, first and foremost, the degree to which a president makes this a priority from the beginning publicly and maintains that priority. I remember when at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, there was this big East Room event, I believe it was in May of 2001, and there were 11 appeals court nominees there, including John Roberts, Miguel Estrada, and others. And it was almost unprecedented to do that with regard to lower court nominees. And then there was virtually nothing to follow through that event. What came next? And therefore that didn't have the kind of impact, in my opinion, that it could have. So it depends on how strongly a president insists that this is the kind of judge I'm going to appoint, and here's why it's important, and why that is more important than gender and race. To the degree that that is done strongly and consistently, we'll have more success. To the degree that that's a weak, muddled, inconsistent, or absent message from the president, we won't have much success.
And I'll point out that I think there has been some progress, even just looking at the contrast between the votes in favor of Sotomayor and the votes in favor of Justice Kagan, where there were fewer people kind of crossing party lines to just support someone on the theory that's been advanced by a lot of senators, that basically how they'll put it is elections have consequences and we should just vote for whoever the president puts up there as long as they're not really egregious. And I think my response would be elections to the Senate also have consequences, and people need to be careful of who they're actually confirming. So I think a lot of the profile of the importance of that those decisions has been raised enough that I think more Republican senators felt like going along to get along is not actually the best strategy here. So that in and of itself is progress, and hopefully we can continue to move in that direction where our senators are educated on this issue.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've lost a couple of questions, so we're down to what looks like our final question for now.
Hi, yes, I'm Vincent Pulignano. I have a question about, I know we've been focusing on the judicial philosophy, but if in the next presidential term there are potentially two or three openings, including Scalia or Ginsburg, how much pressure is on a president to fill those nominations with the right or left-leaning person to replace them? And obviously this would have an effect of who's in the Senate, but if they have the same party in the Senate, then say if it's a Republican president and a Republican Senate, could they just push two Republicans through, even though one might be a left-leaning justice and the other might be a right-leaning justice that are leaving the court?
Well, I think since Ronald Reagan especially, presidents have increasingly articulated what their view of the judiciary is. There's all kinds of analysis about the degree to which they've consistently implemented that view, but they've increasingly been vocal about that. President Obama, more than any president, I mean, he's from the time of his campaign, or when he served in the Senate, to his presidential campaign, to during his presidency, he was repeatedly clear about the kind of judge that he was going to appoint. So, Republican presidents generally have articulated something approaching the judicial philosophy that we're talking about here, if the next president is a Republican, I would expect that president to do that. As to getting those kind of nominees through the Senate, I've talked on the call about some of the factors that are problematic or that make that less than a clear road all the way to the goal. As many people on the call may know, in 2013, Democrats abolished the filibuster for all nominations except the Supreme Court. There was discussion at the beginning of last year whether that should be reinstated under the Republican majority. Many people argued at that time that the filibuster is a tool of the minority, and so therefore it's really only relevant when the president's party runs the Senate, and that certainly proved true last year. We didn't have the filibuster, but we only confirmed 11 judges. But it does exist for the Supreme Court, so that certainly is a factor, a political factor, that a president would have to take into consideration. Again, the goal is to get the best judges possible actually appointed. Sacrificial lambs don't really do much for the actual judiciary and, frankly, can do a lot of damage to the reputation and others of nominees who are willing to put themselves forward. So the goal should be to get as many judges as possible who are as close to this judicial job description as possible. If the president's party is in the minority, well then, let's say it's a Republican president, Democratic Senate, well, they'll control whether to bring a nominee up. I think there's a lot of pressure to, in the case of a Supreme Court nomination, to have a full process, have that go all the way to a vote. But if Democrats are in the minority and there's a Republican president, I mean, they were the ones who started using the filibuster as a tool to defeat majority-supported nominations back in 2003 to begin with. So since that filibuster will be a tool available to the minority for a Supreme Court nomination, that's a factor a president's going to have to factor in. I'll just repeat what I said. To the degree that a president is publicly, consistently articulating, this is the kind of judge our country needs and why, it minimizes factors that will compete with that, and it will minimize the degree to which senators can make decisions on other bases, and it educates the country to understand more about this process. So all of this depends, in my view, on a president strongly leading from the beginning consistently. That will maximize the chances of success.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Tom's last statement that whether it's a filibuster or not, I mean, imagine you've got Democrats who are filibustering a great nominee. If the president is effective at communicating how important these principles are, how principled this potential justice would be, eventually, you know, the political realities will come to bear. They're either going to be, either people will be upset that the president is nominating someone too extreme to be confirmed if their, you know, messaging wins, or they'll be upset that the Senate is blocking someone who ought to be confirmed. And so the key is having a president who's articulate enough and understands the real stakes to be able to go out there and not be afraid of educating people and explaining these points, and then really calling the bluff of assuming we even did have an opposing Senate, calling their bluff and saying I'm going to nominate someone who is principled but obviously highly qualified, et cetera, and then explaining why that's important. So I think if the president does that job, hopefully there's not the same risk that they're going to be blocked by a hostile Senate. But it certainly it illustrates why the Senate is not just the presidential race that people should be keeping an eye on and recognizing the importance of. If you care about the courts, it's also all the senatorial races, because that has a huge impact, of course, of who ends up on the bench.
We do have another question pending, so we've got about 10 minutes left. Let's see if we can get this other question in.
This is Roger Clegg again, and this time I want to ask about the one demographic factor that I think is appropriately considered, and that is age. What do you think the cutoff should be for nominating somebody to the Supreme Court?
You mean in terms of a maximum?
Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, or well, yeah, I wasn't suggesting that somebody might be too young to be on the Supreme Court. I suppose that's also true. But no, I was thinking of, you know, the maximum age because of the fact that you want them to be there for a while.
Well, I think the average is close to 80 for the average retirement age, at least over the last number of decades. And it, you know, if it's the kind of judge we're talking about here, yes, you would want him to be on the Supreme Court for as long as possible. At the same time, you know, I'll take a Clarence Thomas if he's 65. I mean, sure. I mean, Justice Scalia was 50 when he was appointed. He's going to be 80 this spring. Justice Thomas was 43 when he was appointed. So, I mean, you do want them to be on there for as long as possible. At the same time, if you can find a truly stellar nominee who maybe is a little bit older than these youngsters, and the age at which those two justices were appointed is younger than I am, so I feel like an underachiever. But then I don't think that should be necessarily disqualifying. I mean, somebody who's 70 or something like that, well, they're not likely going to be there very long. But you do, you know, you do want them, if they truly are the kind of judge we're talking about, to be on the bench as long as possible.
Makes sense to me.
Curry, do you have a thought on this?
I don't know. I hate to draw a hard line in the sand, but obviously there's certainly going to, at the very least, be a continuum of, you know, the younger they are, the if you have someone who's really solid and young, that's you're buying yourself additional years of probably their term versus someone who's, you know, equivalent and 15 years older. So I think it probably would certainly play in choosing people among a short list, assuming all other things are equal, which of course they never are. So
yeah,
we do have
Tom. That I'm 60, and I wonder about appointing somebody who's 65, even if they were really good. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that there wouldn't be somebody out there who is as good and would be, you know, 20 years younger. But
you know, every nomination and every vacancy has its own unique set of circumstances. If we were in a political situation where the only way to get someone who was truly solid in terms of judicial philosophy confirmed at a given time was to choose someone who was older than you'd like, but who had, as a result of that additional experience, the kind of perhaps reputation or stature in the law that could overcome the kind of opposition that a younger, less known nominee, you know, might endure, that might be the way to go. I mean, so the circumstances vary. I think we all agree that you need the best judges. You want there to be as long on the bench as possible.
Give him a rigorous physical beforehand.
Yeah.
Or her.
Free vegetables and gym membership to go along with it.
Let's make a final call for questions. We don't have any questions pending, but we've got time, I think, for another question. If somebody wants to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, let me give each of you a chance to wrap up, and let's go in the same order in which we began. Carrie Severino, a final thought?
I mean, as a shameless plug, I think this is something people should be really looking for in the current candidates, and there's a website that my organization is working on called SCOTUS2016.com, which collects comments from all the presidential candidates on both sides in everything they've said about judges, things they've done, whether they've been governors before and had opportunities to appoint judges or senators and voted on them, or what they've their comments on Supreme Court cases. So I just think this issue is so crucial for the upcoming election. I think the more the candidates realize it's important to people, the more that when they are president, they will recognize that this is something worth spending the necessary political capital on to find the people who are going to know who to pick, and then to really push for a solid nominee. So as we go into political season, I think it's important for everyone to make sure they're well educated on this issue and vocal about how important it is to the candidates that you have access to.
You might have caught some of our listeners off guard. That was SCOTUS2016.com?
Right.
Okay. SCOTUS2016.com. Good. Tom Jipping, a final thought?
Sure. Just to reemphasize the public nature of the effort, you know, that we've been talking about. It's obviously we have to focus on more narrowly on, you know, on a president, on the Senate confirmation process, but this process, as with politics generally, takes place within a broader context. And the degree to which our fellow citizens have less and less understanding of even the basic elements of our system of government and the job description of a judge, what our judge is supposed to do, is appalling, and it has a dramatic effect on the kind of judges that presidents nominate, on the kind of judges that senators are willing to confirm or oppose, and that's one reason why the Federalist Society has played such an important role for so many years. But it's not just the legal profession either. I mean, if the people out there in real America, my mom and dad in the Midwest or whatever, if they think that, judges are supposed to rule this way or that way in this or that case, if they're supposed to be pro this or anti that, and that's the basis on which they're going to talk about it if they do at all, we're sunk. So everybody needs to be thinking about how they can change things there. It's a really serious problem, but it shapes everything that we're talking about. Everything that a president does, everything that the Senate does, the kind of judges we're going to get on the bench, including the Supreme Court, is going to be shaped by that broader understanding. The founders knew that, and we've lost it. So I think we really need to be thinking about that, and the next president has to include that in any kind of strategy that he has.
Well, Tom Jipping, Terry Severino, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a terrific discussion. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in, some of you who might have been bolstered a little bit by Tom Jipping's assessment that maybe you're still in the right age range to make it to the Supreme Court. I'm a little heartened myself. Also, a reminder to our audience that our next scheduled telephone conference call, 1 p.m. tomorrow. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.